Hello there, and the warmest of welcomes. Yes, the warmest possible welcome to this, the 265th edition of DF Direct Weekly, our weekly show where we discuss the latest gaming and technology news. Joining me, first of all, John Inneman. Hello.
Rich, good to see you again. Looking wonderful there.
Thank you.
Still got the Radeon 7 in the background, which is great, but there's something else over your other shoulder that I'm not sure about.
Okay.
Opposite the PlayStation 5s.
Yeah, that's just a couple of graphics cards. And I think that one is a Radeon RX 9070 XT. Just poking up the corner there. which is going to be extremely fascinating, of course, as usual, to our audio podcast listeners. So thanks for that.
Yes.
And we're also joining me, Oliver McKenzie. Hello.
Yes, we can't forget the podcast listeners, but of course we do produce this show in 4K 60, glorious 4K 60 form for anyone who doesn't want to see the visual references and jokes on screen that John is referencing.
Good stuff. Okay. Well, lots to get through this week, so I suggest we just kick off. Okay, so first news story of the week. Bad news has fallen upon us. Bungie has announced that Destiny 2 is going to be, there's going to be no further content coming for that after the upcoming expansion. Big question marks, therefore, over the entire future of the company, I'd say, because no new projects beyond the recently released Marathon have been announced. No idea what's going on there. There have been various sort of leaks and reports about what they possibly could be up to, but there's no firm project in development as far as we're aware. John, I mean, I don't really know what to say about this one. I mean, it's just not great, really, when you think about the history of this particular developer, the heritage, the quality that this company is capable of. For Bungie to be in that position right now, it's kind of shocking.
Yeah, this is a real sad one, I think, because and this is one I actually don't think we can really lay at the feet of PlayStation even. I think this is just a failure of Bungie management. Talking to people that I know personally that are ex-Bungie now, like just some of the things I've heard about the way the management has started to approach things in the last decade really makes it seem like they genuinely didn't like understand how to move forward and viewed Destiny as this like forever thing that they could just rely on. There was a line about anything single player being a dead boxed game, not worth touching. There's just like this attitude just kind of sucks, and it seems like, as expected, they eventually ran out of gas. But we've expressed plenty of distaste for service games over the years, but I do want to give a shout out to Destiny for being one of the few that genuinely did it really well. Like, I really think Destiny was an awesome experience through and through. Like, both visually and gameplay wise, like it played like Halo in a way, right? It has its own sort of like feel to it, but like they really brought that know-how to Destiny. So the core gunplay, I think, is among the best that ever existed in the space. And then the worlds you explored were actually worlds worth exploring from they're just beautiful, right? These huge open landscapes and gorgeous skies, something Bungie's always known for. I mean, I just feel like every area you visited in this game was just like pure eye candy. Like, even if you go back to those original areas of Destiny 1, which kind of were existing in Destiny 2 after a while, like, they're just awesome looking, right? It's beautiful, beautiful stuff. And I actually think that they created something that was engaging in the sense that it just had this like sense of mystery to it, especially early on. Like, I actually did play a lot of Destiny, and the thing about most service games is that they just feel like services, right? Like, you can just see it through the network of menus and like the way it's all designed. It just feels like, okay, this is designed to be a service first, and they built a game around it. But Destiny actually feels like this mysterious thing where the developers are also learning how to make it as they produced content. And there was just this like layer of mystery and like weirdness to it. And some of that stuff could be viewed in a negative way, but I actually think it made the game kind of compelling because it didn't feel like everything had been like perfectly planned out in this like elaborate, we just want to sell you stuff way, but like an genuinely like a mysterious, cool experience, which is something they excelled with throughout the years with their other games. And like those Destiny raids, like have either of you guys done any of those raids?
I just don't do multiplayer games at this point.
I mean, some of the raids, I remember like the Vault of Glass at the beginning and just like that general experience of like when you get up to that and you get your team together and you have to go through that, like it just felt like you were in this weird uncharted territory of like experiencing challenges and things that you'd just never seen before. And it was really, really interesting. And I think it's some of the best like co-op stuff that I've ever seen. And like all of it was so good that it really made a case for this type of game. And I think most developers were not able to take lessons from Destiny and they didn't actually manage to make it work. And then clearly, I guess, I feel like Bungie's management also didn't understand this. And that's ultimately what led us here today. And that's really, really sad to see. So I think just they couldn't just run on this forever. I mean, Destiny 2 itself, I mean, it's become a whole like just thing, even though it's called 2. Like clearly it was running out of gas. They needed a place to go next and they don't have that. Marathon is a side project. And I'm also a bit sad about Marathon because I think Marathon is like really, really interesting and well done. It's just like ultra hardcore. It's too much for me, even, I would say. Like, the people playing it right now and the numbers aren't that good, but I think the reason is that even though it's conceptually really cool, like, it's so brutal, right? It's found this, like, super hardcore base, but there's a lot of things going on in it that makes it pretty good. So they've never really had a bad game, but I think the management really here has let them down. And so when they talk about all these huge layoffs, it's like, I'd say wipe out the management team first before all the key people, before everyone's gone, right? Like try to leverage that DNA because I still think there's a chance they could make something truly great. Mm. And I hope that they can manage to do that, but I do fear for them at this point, especially with the way Sony is so quick to like cut their investments and run, right?
Right.
Like after what they did to Blue Point and other studios in the past, it feels like nobody's technically safe, right? So it could all just end. But they did pay a lot of money for Bungie, way more than I think they probably should have. And so I hope they actually try to rescue it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how successful they'll be.
Right. Oliver, what's your take on all of this?
Well, I certainly agree with John that the early days of Destiny were quite something, and I remember certain things that were kind of a little bit exploitative, really, like the loot cave that people are shooting into and getting all kinds of goodies out of that, and just some fun times, and a lot of bosses that you could cheese, right, aka use unintentional exploits to manipulate them and make them rather easy to defeat, which me and my friends certainly did back in the days of Destiny 1. That was part of the game's charm, and I really do feel like some of that perhaps was lost. But yeah, overall, I mean, it seemed like they were winding down Destiny 2 development to some degree after the release of the final shapes, failed to sustain like really high player count for a long time there. But in general, it seems to me like there were some significant technical failures with this game, difficulties with content production that made them stretch out the timelines of when they were delivering things, and then also infamously issues with content vaulting over the years, like in 2020, vaulted a bunch of content. That's stuff that, you know, we do not see with other games like World of Warcraft, for instance, which has, you know, it's a different kind of game, but it's still a live service game, still kind of an MMO-style game. They deliver content updates, major ones, every 8 weeks, huge expansions every 2 years, or they're even accelerating that down to 18 months or so now with the latest expansion. They deliver a ton of game content, and importantly, they don't vault any old game content. And indeed, they make it relevant by allowing you to level scale and go through any of those old expansions and old content as like a leveling experience, which is really cool. So I always felt like in Destiny, there was this absence of the expanding world that we saw in World of Warcraft, in part because this content vaulting happening in part because of the technical limitations they seem to have had with just creating an increasingly expanding world. And I think they were talking about also just disk space limitations, where the game was expanding in size by like 15 gigs or 20 gigs a year, and that's probably not sustainable ultimately, right? World of Warcraft figured out various streaming solutions to that. Perhaps in due course they could have figured out something similar to this. But I feel like there was just an issue with Destiny 2 where after 9 years, it's kind of a hard game to jump back into, and you establish so much content over that period. I think a lot of players are looking for an opportunity with maybe a new entry, like a Destiny 3, as was the original plan, right? The original plan was to do, I think, a Destiny title every 2 years with an expansion every 1 year. Now, perhaps that was a bit ambitious, but I still think there should have been a Destiny 3 that brought players back into the fold, that introduced new concepts, new ideas, introduced, I think more importantly, a new technical foundation for the game that made it easier to iterate on and develop over time. I think that's really important. So I think Destiny 2, like, I don't know, it's a fun game. I played a fair bit of it when it launched, but I was really looking forward to something Destiny 3 to clean up some of these issues. And unfortunately, it seems like that will never materialize. On the plus side, though, it does seem like they're leaving the game in a reasonable state. Like, they're rebalancing items, they're adding some remix-style gameplay systems, and they're retooling it to stand alone permanently and adding a bunch of content in at the end here. So that's at least a reasonable way to end the game, end the game's live service development. It reminds me a little bit of what the developers did of Wayfinder back, I think, a couple of years ago, where they basically retooled the game as a single-player title. This isn't quite to that extent, but they have kind of left it in a position where hopefully it won't need too much active development. So, yeah, I think this is, I mean, maybe ultimately this is for the best, but I'm not really seeing any particularly promising projects, given that it seems based on the reporting that Destiny 3 has not been greenlit, which is obviously a lot of what, well, you know, what players are interested in as the new Destiny title. And then, of course, Marathon's concurrent player numbers on Steam probably tell you a lot of the story there, and then also their rankings on Xbox and whatnot. They don't seem to be doing too well with that title. So the prospect of moving a lot of Destiny developers over to Marathon to help right that sinking ship, you know, it's a bit of a long shot at the moment, I think, given player interest in Marathon. They have to change a lot of things, even just the core concept behind it, which is that it's the extraction shooter. I don't think it's very promising for them, although I do wish them the best of luck there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can't really comment on Destiny 2 because it's the type of game where I just don't have the time to invest in it. However, a couple of people on my timeline, on my Twitter timeline, certainly do, and are both equally devastated by the demise of Destiny 2. And one of them has quite a negative outline on the way the game has progressed over the years. The other, somewhat positive. I'm going to start here with Tim Clark, the brand director of PC Gamer. Now, in terms of journalism, Tim commands a lot of respect, certainly from me. His reaction: awful, awful news. Books canon should be written about the mismanagement of Destiny 2, which I maintain is one of the greatest games ever made, and one which still has vast potential. But it has become utterly impossible to trust Bungie to deliver. I'm so angry at how fast it has been left to rot. No doubt the final shape should have been the endpoint, but the self-inflicted wounds since then have been so depressing to watch. The design of the portal will go down as one of the all-time mistakes in game development, but the catastrophic errors date all the way back to the first days of D1 and the idiotic decision to launch with double primaries and fixed perk roles. We're getting deep into the lore here. Partly thanks to the same devs who went on to make Concord, it took a year to unpick that blindingly obvious mistake. I say all of this as somebody for whom Destiny is still my favorite game of all time. I forged friendships and had experiences I never thought possible thanks to a video game. The work done by the art team, the raid team, the sound team, and often the sandbox team was peerless. If you only know Destiny 2 by its deservedly terrible reputation, then you have missed out on one of, if not the best-feeling PvE shooters of all time. It was one of the most important games ever made, as time will reflect. Its death is a tragedy, but an overdue one. And conversely, Thomas Puhr, the communications director of Remedy, has a somewhat different take. Destiny 2 has kept me going when the going has been hard at Remedy for my 11 years at the studio. It's always been hard for a workaholic like me. That's what making video games is. Being able to load into D2 was a blessing, a relationship. It was always there and brought so many of us together for incredible moments of triumphs and despair. For example, when it was the sixth hour of Nezarek in Pantheon for the second day in a row, or was it third? Having known many of the key D2 devs, it's been tiring to read over the years how much shit Bungie management got. It's never that clear cut. What Destiny 2 has done won't be repeated. This was a groundbreaking game, but Activision bankrolled in a crazy way, and kudos for that. Never was it possible to upkeep the kind of game D1 and early D2 were. Way, way too expensive. Small miracle it has lasted this long. I guess in due course, we're going to find out what's actually going to happen to Bungie. Bloomberg are talking about layoffs. There are game concepts in development at Bungie. But I think the takeaway is that there doesn't seem to be a clear strategy or outlook for the future of the studio. And I think you're right, John. It's deeply worrying when you consider what happened to Bluepoint in particular, right?
Absolutely. It's going to take some serious leadership to get this back on track, right? I don't think it's over, but it could be. And we're going to see what happens, I guess, in the near future.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they can just spin up and do Destiny again either. Like, I think they need to do something else.
Right.
We'll see how it goes. I do think one of the problems I think they faced with Destiny is that the way that these games work, you're always going to have some users that like chew through all the content you made in like super fast amount of time. And then you're going to have other users that take a much longer time to see it, right? Mm-hmm. They play differently. How do you please them both, right? Because some users would feel like they don't play it enough so that when something new comes out, they feel totally lost, right? There's all this new stuff. It's not really that well explained. You just feel like, maybe I'm out of this now. But then you have the other users that get through it so fast, and they're just like, where's the update? Where's the update? Where's the update? And like making something for that such a different audience like that seems pretty tough. Yeah. So I feel for them in that. Personally, and I don't know if this probably wouldn't save the studio. I would really like to see them do like a Halo class product again, where it's like a really good single player game with a really good multiplayer component.
Right.
If they could pull that off, that would be amazing, but who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, thoughts with Bungie. Final thoughts there, Oliver?
Yeah, I do feel like, I don't want to come back to World of Warcraft again, but like I do feel, although I do from time to time, unfortunately, but I do feel like Blizzard maybe has the right attitude here, where they basically gives them a lot of overlapping reasons to log back in to games like this, especially like really dedicated players, like offering obviously new content, but on top of that, remixing old content and adding difficulty ladders into new content. So you might have like mythic versions, heroic versions, all kinds of different elements of the same raid. And then also you might have like different kinds of remixes of old content, which it sounds like they are doing in Destiny 2, but in World of Warcraft they have all kinds of old expansions, all kinds of old stuff, no vaulting here, you know, all kinds of stuff that's added into the gameplay rotation from many expansions ago. And given that every expansion adds like multiple raid tiers and many dungeons and things like this, there's a ton of content to go through. And then also like stuff that's in Destiny 2 as well, but obviously cosmetic farming and things like that are a big part of it as well. So I think what John's saying is absolutely true. You'll never be able to feed the most dedicated players with a stream of new content to sate their appetites all the time. And Destiny 2 in recent times was not even attempting to get anywhere remotely close to doing that. But I think you can keep people grinding on the ladder if they're invested enough in your game, if they have enough compelling social experiences in your game. I think you can do it, and there are like tried and tested ways to do it. I think Bungie's problem was just iterating and shipping on that content without breaking things. Like, I think they had a lot of problems with just delivering updates with a relatively small team. I don't think they could have done it because of the fact they had so much technical debt built up into their gameplay systems. Not a very good situation there. But ultimately, I mean, I think the whole situation with Bungie is a little bit upsetting, and it's not a very good situation. And I'd love to see a Destiny 3. I don't think it's very likely. I think they'd probably have to staff up considerably for that project, or perhaps pull a lot of resources from Marathon, which it sounds like they're trying to save. Maybe a version of Marathon could expand out to be like this really cool, you know, properly Marathon-styled, perhaps, PvE shooter that we all, I think, want to see from Bungie. But they seem very tooled as a multiplayer-focused studio, and that's what I think PlayStation intends them to be. So hopefully they do get the opportunity, though, to work on some single-player content for whatever they work on next. I hope it's substantially a single-player adventure, if it's not Destiny 3.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Well, as I said, all the best to Bungie and the staff there. Let's move on. Okay, so we're going to be talking about a lot about Unreal Engine 5 in this particular episode of DF2 Weekly. Lots of games to discuss. We're going to kick off with the release this week, as we tape this, of LEGO Batman Legacy of the Dark Knight. Embargo was a few days ago, weirdly we didn't receive any code, and chasing up, we never received any code either, which is slightly strange. But it did weirdly have an early access period if you bought the game, so that's exactly what we did. We're going to be taking a look at it at PlayStation 5 and the PC. Where should we begin? Oliver, should we talk about PlayStation 5 here?
Yeah, so this is kind of an interesting game, because I remember pre-release, people were really spooked by the concept that they would demand frame generation for a 30 FPS experience, even if that meant low-end graphics hardware, because obviously the PC specs, I think, stipulated that low-end GPUs would have to use frame generation to hit 30 FPS, which would obviously imply an internal frame rate of 15 FPS. Not very promising. So I kind of assumed this was like Unreal Engine 5 with all the bells and whistles and kind of pushed up the nines. But it doesn't really seem to be that way, because in terms of visual features, I don't know that it's using Lumen in any form based on what we're seeing here, for a few reasons. Like the visual results really don't resemble Lumen. Like, there's no large scale occlusion, no obvious light bounce off light materials, and it has even an SSAO option in the console settings, which is quite remarkable. So you can actually turn on or off SSAO in this game, which obviously would not be something you would expect if it was using Lumen. And if you do turn it off, the game has an extremely uniform lighting appearance, indicating that for the diffuse indirect lighting, they really are depending heavily on SSAO. And then the reflections appear to be SSR-based with no SDF fallback that I can see, just based on, you know, manipulating the camera and adjusting perspective and things like that. But in general, it doesn't look too bad overall, but just the fact that the lighting presentation is taken back in those respects by, it seems like, not really relying on Lumen, it does bring the lighting presentation back to a bit of a more primitive lighting presentation, which I think you can tell in this footage here as I'm panning around. But on the plus side, the Lego bricks, that all looks great. Breaking them apart and build into interesting structures, that looks cool. The brickwork is detailed and has plenty of surface imperfections and things like that. And it can look quite good in some areas. I think one issue with these Traveler's Tales games that I think John also will probably echo here is that because they are larger scale games, they aren't being made exclusively, or obviously the game isn't being made out of anything, but like they're being given the appearance of being made exclusively out of Lego bricks, unlike in some other titles like Lego Horizon Adventures, another UE5 title, but one that does make use of Lumen, for instance. That title, everything is made out of the actual Lego bricks themselves. Also with a title like Lego Builder's Journey, again, very small scale, even relative to Horizon Adventures, but everything is made out of Lego bricks in that title, including elements that are fluid, like water. They find a way to do that, so that's quite a cool look. I also ran into one area early on where there was like a bit of a performance issue. I didn't get capture of it, unfortunately, but there was some kind of like frame pacing issue or issue with camera jitter or another similar issue during an intense sequence. That was not too promising. But overall, it's like 30 FPS by default, fidelity mode, runs okay outside of that one issue. Does have a 60 FPS mode as well, which feels kind of heavy in the hand, but I did check around for frame generation and I didn't spot obvious signs of it in my footage, so I'm presuming it's not frame gen, although I did suspect that briefly might be the case. Image quality looks fine in the fidelity mode, and performance mode it's somewhat more compromised and maybe a little bit over sharp with a default sharpness, which you can adjust, by the way. But yeah, I think probably the story here is more of like production efficiency and moving away from what were apparently, according to people who spoke to media who work inside the studio, a very troubled engine that Traveler's Tales was using before. Moving over to Unreal probably eased a lot of those production burdens and made this game actually feasible to deliver in a reasonable span of time. But I don't really think there's like a really strong rendering story in the sense that moving from basically last generation technology that was more primitive in terms of its rendering features, I don't think we're seeing a huge upgrade in terms of the core rendering. Probably just because if you're not using Lumen and you're using Unreal Engine 5, I don't think you're going to get a tremendous result in a lot of these areas, right? You're not necessarily going to get that real next generation visual appearance when it comes to some of the areas that gamers are kind of really looking to see improved here.
John, you've looked at PC. What do you think?
So the first thing that struck me then is that this is one of many LEGO Batman games, I guess, right? LEGO Batman goes back to PlayStation 2, and on there it actually looks quite good, I would say. I took a look at that as well, and obviously there's a pretty significant evolution here, but there's older games, they still hold up really well. And this new one, I was indeed disappointed by the fact that they switched to Unreal. I understand why for their process, given what they've said in interviews, but, you know, Traveler's Tales was known as a company that sort of used their own technology for a long time, so this does feel like a step back in some ways. But they've done a good enough job. As Oliver noted, I don't think it looks as good as the Horizon LEGO game overall, but, you know, Lumen has its own issues today, and a lot of people don't like it, specifically with the way it temporally resolves, and the extra requirements often reduce image quality significantly. So, but still, Hardware Unboxed actually did a really interesting video basically pointing out that, yeah, the requirements were nonsense and it doesn't require frame generation to get to 30 FPS. And this bears out in my look at the PC. So the game runs great on high-end PCs, but it's also still playable on something like a Steam Deck. So it's not something that you need to have a super high-end machine to handle. But of course, the 5090 experience, you know, of course, the ultra high-end experience. This is not what most people are going to be playing with, but it's nice to see it that you can run this with full resolution. You don't even need DLSS if you don't want to. It's very easy to run this game on a powerful PC, and the image quality is extremely sharp, which does help a lot with a game where you have these little LEGO people running around. It definitely contributes to the almost sometimes CGI-like aesthetic. The shadows are really well done as well. Everything's super, super sharp there. The self-shadows, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it did make me think, though, because in some ways it's just another Traveler's Tales LEGO game, and I'm wondering if that weird requirement sheet ended up giving them more attention that they may not have otherwise got, right? Like, everybody started talking about this game. I didn't hear anyone mention it until that came out. And then it just feels like it was dominating conversations. So maybe, I don't know, job well done there.
What?
But
it's one of the worst. It's one of the worst marketing mistakes, I think, in recent times.
Yeah, but like, Rich, the result is everybody talked about the game, and then it comes out, and everybody's like, "Oh, wait, it's way less demanding than the specs suggest," which actually ends up being good news. So you're surprised in a positive way.
What? No. That's not the way information exchange is meant to work.
It shouldn't work that way, but I think that may have actually occurred here.
I've just brought up the PC system requirements. Requirements, that's the word. So this is the system that you require. And they are saying that on the minimum, you're going to need a 4 GB graphics card, anything from a GTX 960 to a Radeon RX 6400 to an Arc A580, which in itself is quite a spread of performance. I'm not quite sure you'd want to be running a GTX 960 on this game. But yes, they are literally saying you're going to need to use frame generation to get 30 FPS. And and as you know, Tim from Hardware Unboxed revealed, actually you don't. So yeah, maybe they have raised awareness, but they raised awareness in a wholly negative way. And you know, basically, I think would have put a lot of people off from certainly from pre-ordering it, which is not a good idea. So I'm just baffled by all of these specs because, you know, as has been demonstrated by Hardware Unboxed, you just don't need frame generation. It just, none of this makes any sense. And if you think about it, they've got a Switch 2 version coming. Now, you know, the whole, you know, when you think about the Lego games, they're family friendly games. You want them to be enjoyed on as wide a range of systems as possible, right? So the concept that you're sort of positing this game as like a high-end PC experience that requires high-end PC components, and you still need frame generation, is entirely at odds with the way this game was likely architected and budgeted to begin with. Yeah, I'm just sort of, you know, I think this is, you know, a major marketing misstep that has caused a lot of damage. And why? You know, because how did they come up with these specs? You know, was there something wrong with their PCs? Is there like some sort of stage later in the game that is like, you know, 2 to 3 times more demanding than the actual bits that Hardware Unboxed looked at? The whole thing is just completely baffling. Oliver?
It is confusing, but at the same time, I don't want to give their game too many plaudits here, because the game, with low settings as Hardware Unboxed is testing here, which perhaps I can feature on screen briefly, it really does not look very good at like 1080p low settings with FSR balance. Like, you don't have any, you know, all the lights are no longer shadow casting, and it looks very basic, I'd have to say. I think they strip a lot of the volumetrics out of the presentation. It doesn't really look like we're used to seeing from Unreal, stripped back in some of its lower end settings, but with still with the key like Lumen, VSM, whatever, Nanite, everything enabled here, that doesn't really seem to be the case as much. So it does not look super impressive, but I do agree those specs are a little bit quizzical, because I'm seeing here an average FPS of like 62 FPS on a 6500 XT, which is one of the, you know, lower end GPUs they're specifying. And that's certainly a lot higher than 30 FPS, and it's certainly a lot higher than 30 FPS with frame generation and an internal frame rate of 15 FPS. So I'm not sure how they arrived at those figures. Maybe those are like very worst case figures potentially. But I don't think that really fits with the general expectation of what a minimum and recommended setting should look like for a PC game.
Yeah, it's all completely baffling. I'm just trying to draw a parallel to maybe some other kind of negative marketing issue that might sort of make people talk about your game, John. You know, what would you do, you know, bring out a trailer for a new game running at 30 FPS with frame gen, say, hey, look, check this out, look at our new game, pre-order now.
Oh, I don't think this was intentional necessarily. I'm just saying that it played out in a way that, first of all, only the more hardcore people are even going to notice this, right, or think about it. And they're the ones that will be pleasantly surprised when it turns out that it doesn't run like that, because they're keeping up with the situation. The more family oriented people, the main audience, probably will have never seen that requirement sheet, will not have participated in any of that discussion, and they're just going to get the game. So I don't know. And I feel like hardcore people would not have talked about this game if not for that weird requirement sheet. So again, I'm not saying they did this intentionally, but I'm saying it worked out in a way that the game got more attention than it might have otherwise gotten from a certain subset of the audience.
I need to know the methodology by which they actually came up with this spec sheet. I just need, you know, I need to understand how this happened.
Maybe it was AI's fault.
Well, baffling. I'm not sure we're going to do too much more on Lego Batman. We still haven't got the game from Warner Brothers. Bizarre. But there we are. Let's move on. Okay, so next news topic of the week. And Tom Morgan, you're joining us for this one. Thank you for looking into this one for us. Yoshi and the Mysterious Book on Nintendo Switch 2, Unreal Engine 5. But you wouldn't believe it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Just a cameo for this one. Hello. Yeah, another Unreal Engine 5 game for this episode, but with a very different art style, aesthetic, and you'd expect it from the developer, given their track record with the Yoshi series. So we'll go back a little bit quickly. We've got the Mysterious Book here, but previously they Good Feel have done Yoshi's Crafted World on the Switch in 2019, which was Unreal Engine 4, which was all arts and crafts and very kind of a great aesthetic. And before that, they had Yoshi's Woolly World in 2015, okay. which was a Wii U game. Not sure about the engine on that one, but it was mostly knitted aesthetic, like wool-based stuff. So with the Mysterious Book today on Switch 2, which is an exclusive Switch 2 game, they've kind of abandoned all that arts and crafts stuff, and then they've gone back to the style of Super Mario World 2 Yoshi's Island on Super NES, with a very watercolor style, and it almost looks like sprite work. It's very appealing. It's a completely new direction for this current run, and they do a very good job, and they've transitioned to Unreal Engine 5, of course, with a few things that they've done to kind of tweak it to add to that cel-shaded look. One of the things in the intellectual property notices of the game is UE5's stylized post-process feature, which gives it that cel-shaded look. You've got sketch lines and that sort of watercolor aesthetic anytime you enter the Mysterious Book. And anytime you're outside it, you've got more conventional rendering techniques, you know, with all the Yoshis cuddled around the book, waiting for their turn to jump in. So it's a very nice idea, and they play with it in some really fun ways. Like every instruction and every task you've got to do within a level is sketched in within the level itself. And yeah, everything looks about as distant from what you'd think a Unreal Engine 5 game would look like, which is, in my book, a great kind of move.
Absolutely. And you've looked at it at both docked and mobile configurations, right?
Yes. So it's a weird one in terms of the resolution setup, because they are doing quite a few tricks under the hood to kind of achieve that look, right? They've got stop motion animations and that sort of cel-shaded style. But underneath it is actually some proper, you know, it's quite a taxing approach to do this, and they have actually nerfed the resolution accordingly. So docked, it's 540p while inside the book itself, and then when you step outside the book and you're kind of peering in, it's 1080p. In portable play, it's 360p while inside the book, and then 720p while outside. So all that creates a very, it's a pixelated, mushy look, I guess. And honestly, I didn't mind in terms of the way it looks inside the Mysterious Book itself. It kind of adds that sort of, there's a mushy appearance to watercolor paintings anyway, so it lends to it. But you might notice some pixelation on the backgrounds, especially like thin details. So yeah, on top of that, I didn't notice much in the way of anti-aliasing, you know, treatment of edges or visual noise. There's stuff like, you know, flickering on the book edges and the mustache of the book as well, which is you know, it goes against the theory that TSR is engaged in some way. But it's yeah, it certainly is not the crispest game you might see on Switch 2.
Mm-hmm. Okay. John, you took a look at this one as well a while back, right?
Yeah, I had a chance to play for an hour or so of this, and it is interesting. The image quality is not amazing. I don't think we can say it's just running at 540p straight with no treatment, though, because it definitely looks sharper than just like native 540p right. with no AA. I mean, that's effectively just above like Xbox and PS2 resolution at this point, right? Which would not hold up well, but it is definitely a soft game. I do think the visual style, in some ways, I might argue, I actually think it looks worse than the wool one.
Right.
I think that was on Wii U, if I recall, Tom.
Yep.
Yeah, that one still holds up really well. This one definitely has that heavy post-process look to it. I don't think it's bad, but it's not stunning. But I do like how they've done the decimated animation effect to essentially simulate sprites.
Yeah.
Right? Like, they kind of did this in Super Mario Wonder as well, right? Where you don't draw smooth translations between every frame of animation, and that makes it look more 2D-like, which is very, very cool. The whole game, though, is quite a departure, I think, from the traditional sort of Yoshi platformers, which they are generally quite easy, but this one here is more of a puzzle game.
Right.
Where you're kind of like going into the book and it's like you have to like figure out like, oh, like collect these things or like make these flowers bloom somewhere. And it's basically figuring out like where to go and like what to trigger. And you're like trying to do this in each level. So it is kind of a fun take on it, I guess. And it's definitely not a game where it's going to punish you because it doesn't seem like you actually can like really lose. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
You can't die.
No. So, you know, it's interesting. I'm not as inspired by this as some of the other stuff. And Good Feel definitely has a mixed track record. Like they are actually... The founders are ex-Konami guys with a lot of history, including Goemon, which is why they also produced that, or they developed that Bakeru game, which came out on Switch and PC, which was essentially a Goemon spiritual successor, but that ran on the Unity engine.
Oh, Christ.
So, which is really interesting, which it ran horrible on the original Switch, but it runs super smooth on Switch 2, thankfully.
Yeah.
This is at least not that kind of thing, but I don't know, it's interesting. I will say one thing I want to hear though, Tom, if you don't mind, can I get your best Yoshi?
I'll give it a go. Oh my gosh.
That was great.
Thank you.
I think Nintendo, you found a new Yoshi if you need one.
Maybe I've missed a trick not going to voice acting. That was for so good. Dinosaurs.
Can we re-record exactly. The whole segment with you doing that voice?
No.
We don't want to lose too many listeners. But that was really good, Tom, I must admit.
Thank you.
Well done, my friend.
Years of practice, you know, in the bathroom.
Oliver, do you have anything to add? I mean, Unreal Engine 5 here. I mean, I don't think we're looking at Lumen or Nanite.
No. It's doubtful. It's Unreal Engine 5, but deployed in a manner very much unlike other Unreal Engine 5 titles that I have to expect. In terms of the aliasing presentation, I mean, I don't know if they're using any kind of upscaler or whatever, but I just think just the fact they're relying so heavily on outline shaders is going to diminish the aliasing presentation of the visuals no matter what they do, I feel like. Like, there's kind of a mix, I think, here of stuff that's actually baked into the artwork, that's been painted into the artwork, the kind of lines and things like that, perhaps, that have been baked into that texture art. And then some elements that are being done in real time to kind of graphically stylize the output, like the outline shaders, like, I'm sure, all kinds of other visual effects that are present in this footage. And, you know, I think it looks reasonable, but I agree the reliance on things like outline shaders and these real-time effects does give it a somewhat, like, post-processed quality that does not feel quite as natural, maybe, as some of the other Yoshi efforts, where I felt like, you know, Yoshi's Woolly World, Yoshi's Crafted World did feel more like kind of a genuine finished article, and this kind of feels a little bit more digital and a little bit further removed, perhaps, from the phenomena that it's trying to emulate in real life, the kind of imagery that it's trying to emulate in real life. I'm also not as much of a fan of the switch from platforming to puzzling. I rather liked the Yoshi platformers. They weren't the hardest, but they were breezy games, they were fun games, they were very delightful titles, and no reason why this couldn't also be delightful, but I'm just not that interested in, like, this kind of puzzle, light puzzle, exploration type game. I'd prefer a game with a little bit more kind of structured platforming, even if it's not challenging platforming. Like, that kind of experience, I think I'd prefer that. So, not my cup of tea, but, I mean, it looks competent. And it does run at a stable 60 FPS, right, Tom, pretty much?
Almost. It's in terms of the... There's two parts. There's the bits inside the mysterious book, which is the bulk of it anyway, which is 60 with drops to 55 or so. On, obviously, the VRR will clear that up, but on docked play, I think I noticed a bit of that. But it's not like a fast-paced game, really, so I don't think I was that bothered about...
Pretty rare, too, I think.
Pretty rare, too, yeah. And the more obvious one is when you zoom out and look at the mysterious book, and you're leafing through the pages, picking your next level. That's your kind of interface to everything you found, all the nicks and knacks you picked up. And that drops to like 30 to 40 FPS, which is odd, but that might explain, you know, be explained by the resolution increase in that bit.
Okay, fair enough. Without giving away any spoilers, Tom, what is mysterious about the book?
I have no idea. It's literally the story is like Kamek, one of the like villains of the Mario universe, finds it and it's dropped. The Yoshis all huddle around and find it. And everything, all the pages are left blank, and it's your job to fill them in and, you know, spot things with a giant magnifying glass. And once you find a creature, that creature unlocks a new bit of a level, and you go explore that bit of the level. And it's just about filling out the book, and maybe that's the mystery. What's beyond the next page?
Okay.
I think the biggest mystery for me is why these games became so easy. Like, Oliver, you mentioned that the series is traditionally very easy, and that's largely true, but that started with essentially the second game on N64, right? Mm-hmm. The original Yoshi's Island on Super NES is a difficult game. It's one of the harder, like, 2D Mario games, I would say. And then they just kind of, like, totally nerfed it, and the series kind of focused on very, very easy platforming and action.
Okay.
I'm not sure what's up with that, but yeah, whatever. That's what they decided to do.
It might be just because they've got Mario, which is almost like, in terms of difficulty, right? Like, Mario is fair, can get quite challenging. Maybe Kirby's the next rung down intermediate, and they've seen like an area in the market for something a bit more entry level, and that's Yoshi's turn, I guess.
There we go.
Yeah.
I had no idea that the characters were sort of demographically adjusted for difficulty. It'd be quite an interesting thing. I haven't really got too much to say about this because I haven't played it. I do think, though, that the aesthetic here is interesting, but the previous entries, right, they really had like a fantastic visual identity. You know, they looked awesome. They looked unlike any other game. I'm not really seeing, I mean, shades of it maybe, but not quite the same on this one.
No.
But we're not done with Unreal Engine 5. But thanks so much for taking a look at this one for you, Tom. I guess we could send you back to work now.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good luck with the rest of the Direct.
Cheers. Okay, so we're going to be sticking, yes we are, with Unreal Engine 5 titles. But a couple more games that you wanted to talk about, John. And again, very different type of presentation than we'd normally expect, right?
Correct. So I specifically wanted to highlight these as two examples of using Unreal to do something that looks visually distinct and doesn't feel Unreal, if you will. The first of which is a game I actually covered last year for the PC. It now has arrived on consoles, and I've played it on the PlayStation 5 Professional, and it's Riven from Cyan Worlds. And I wanted to highlight this for two reasons. First of all, I want to support this studio still because I think they are the longest running independent studio either in the world or at least in the US. They have been independent since, I guess, the 80s, if you will.
Wow.
It's been a long time and they're still around, but they've definitely fallen on some hard times, as I understand. But Riven was a remake of their mid to late 90s sequel to Myst. And compared to the remakes of Myst, I think this one is far, far more engaging and impressive. I think Riven was always the better game, and its visual style back in the day was superlative. And these guys have leveraged modern technology to so beautifully recreate that aesthetic in full 3D, which means that you can now wander around that world freely. I loved it on the PC last year. I loved it in VR last year. They even shipped a Meta Quest version, which was pretty cut down, admittedly, but it still kind of looked okay. But this is an example of a game that doesn't actually leverage any of the new features of Unreal. Although the PC version did end up with some cool ray tracing features after the fact, which fixes some of the faults with the reflections, right? But this is a game that is baked out with lighting. It doesn't use like nanite or anything like that. And yet you have this extreme granularity and beautifully crafted environments. And I think it just shows that your game doesn't have to have that quote unquote Unreal look. This still feels very unique. The color scheme, the way it all comes together, I think they did a phenomenal job. And on PlayStation 5, at least on the Pro, which is what I've sampled thus far, it's pretty good. But it's not flawless. I did note that the frame rate can slip just a little under 60 in very specific areas. And you can fix this with a VRR screen, mind you, because it is high enough. but it wasn't 100% flawless 60 in my experience. But still, it's mostly there based on what I've played thus far, and it does feel good on a controller. I'm sure the PC version supported that. I played it with a mouse and keyboard, but playing with a controller now, you know, the interface is well adapted, and it is possible to enjoy it. And it's just neat seeing this sort of receive a console release like this. And yeah, if you enjoy these sort of mysterious puzzle-driven games, seriously, you must give it a work. You must give it a look. Also, it supports PSVR 2, which the PSVR 2 has not received a lot of love in recent times. Although there is a pretty interesting Little Nightmares game that got a release on multiple VR platforms. But since this also supported PC VR, Quest VR, now we get PSVR 2 VR, and the experience is much more in line with what you get on the PC versus, say, the MetaQuest version. So it's not stripped down that much. But it's interesting because you have to be kind of comfortable to play it, because you will walk around and be confused for hours, which is not a bad thing in these worlds, I swear. It's actually
the story of my life, really.
Sure, yes. But I think this is just it's a really cool experience, and it's a good use of this technology to do what these guys have always been sort of building towards, I think. And they've made some original games as well, such as Abduction and Firmament, which are also on PlayStation. But I think Riven, this is the perfect encapsulation of everything Cyan has built over the years. And one of their best products ever. So do check it out if that sounds appealing, right? So I don't know. Did any of you guys have experience with Riven?
No, not since the original. And that's so long ago that I just don't really remember anything about it.
Oh, man, yeah.
Yeah, I totally agree with what John is saying about this game. I do think it looks quite pretty, and I think at least that level of visual sophistication is translated pretty well across its various host platforms. Although I think, like on Quest, it's a little rough looking, but everything else looks good. But I'd also say that this title, I mean, looking at it now, I can't help but think that this would be a pretty good UE5 fit, potentially. It looks kind of like UE5 demo content in terms of the kinds of environments it's rendering, because there's very little foliage. It's all stark rock faces and bright lighting with lots of bounce potentially in those bright environments. It's archaeological, and it has a lot of very dense natural geometry. So I think this would work pretty well with a system like Lumen and Nanite and VSM working there. I think it would even work pretty well on older UE5, like UE5.1 versions or something with that feature set. I think it would look pretty good, actually. You know, this is like Lumen in the line of Nanite kind of demo content here. So I think, I mean, as good as it does look, I think it does look quite good. Maybe this kind of slower paced game set in this kind of environment would actually be a pretty reasonable choice for a nice UE5 tech showcase. If a developer did want to iterate on the point and click genre with another one of these games at some point, I think it could be done.
I would say, Oliver, in this case, while I agree about the aesthetic purposes there, I actually think their very limited ray tracing on PC made more sense. Okay. In that essentially it gets rid of screen space reflections and replaces them with ray traced reflections, which enhances the rendered look. Lumen would be cool, but because this game is so static, right, it does not have time of day changes, and everything is very specifically designed to look exactly one way. This is a case where I think the sort of temporal noise of Lumen may not necessarily be the best fit.
Right.
It would be interesting to see it, but I think they made the right choice for this game, and it does show that it can still work, right?
Cool. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I played another game that I wanted to highlight because it really captivated me in a weird way. And it kind of goes in an opposite direction. It's called Motor Slice. And this is a sort of, what can I say? It's an atmospheric platforming action game. I definitely got those same kind of vibes I got from playing Eco back in the day, but it's not exactly like that type of game. You're essentially infiltrating this gigantic, a cement city, almost brutalist-like, but with some weird bright colors. It's all abandoned, covered in sand, and you're playing as a character that's meant to just destroy all of the machines, and your weapon is a sword that's also a chainsaw, because why not? They actually do this really cute thing where the camera is actually a physical object in the world, where it's a small drone that follows you around and actually has some personality. And so you're basically controlling the drone. It really becomes clear when you turn on the flashlight, because the flashlight beam emanates from the drone. So your character casts a shadow because you're the one, your camera is the one projecting the light. But the game itself goes for a more simplistic design. It uses unfiltered textures, right? So it's pixelated, but not warped like PlayStation, but it's still of that era. And it's got more like PS2 like geometry, I would say, with like large flat surfaces, nice looking characters. The main character, I think, looks good. And the animation is nice and everything, but where they actually leveraged Unreal is that this is a case where they did use Lumen. And I think with this sort of simple geometry and old look, I actually would say it turned out really nice, because it does have this like supernatural look that almost makes it look like you're peering into a model of like a PS1 aesthetic game a little bit. You know what I mean? Where it's like the objects now have this tangibility that you normally don't see. So it's like fusing retro with this like very natural soft lighting. And I find that like very appealing. And I'm playing this on PlayStation 5 on the Pro, of course, because that's what I have hooked up. And it's just a perfect 60 frames per second. And they made a decision where the image quality is super, super clean, but it's very soft. And I think it's on purpose, right? Where the edges are all just a bit soft with no aliasing. And I think you don't necessarily want like a super sharp native 4K looking game in this case, because of the low polygon aesthetic. And it works. So not only is it beautiful, but it's just a really cool game so far from what I've played the first three chapters, and I'm compelled to keep going. So I wanted to highlight that as well as a completely different looking example of UE5 being used in a way that works really well, and Lumen actually works well in a way that shouldn't bother people, and it actually benefits the game's visual design in a fun way.
Nice. Excellent stuff. Any reactions there, Oliver?
Oh, I do like this combination of constrained assets and, you know, intentional kind of asset limitations, like obviously the unfiltered textures that John mentioned and the polygonal restrictions they seem to have placed themselves under for designing these characters and environments in the first place. And even like on the characters, I'm noticing in some of the footage here, they have almost like intentionally limited animation sets and moves where they're moving in a really broad way, kind of like Cloud or something, in ways that you would not expect from a modern action game. But combining all of that kind of early 3D pastiche kind of look with really high-end lighting, I think it produces a great result here. It's a kind of look that I think we're seeing in a lot of other titles as well, including, for instance, in some of the RTX remasters we've seen from NVIDIA, and obviously a lot of people using RTX Remix. But I think it's a cool look, and it definitely works for this title. And I do agree that Lumen adds a lot of high-fidelity lighting detail in a way that looks really, really striking when you pair it with a lot of like low frequency texture work and relatively basic environments. It makes that lighting detail stand out all the more. Whereas in some other games that are more visually sophisticated, it almost gets lost in the kind of visual noise of it all, and you don't really see that nice ambient shadowing, nice indirect diffuse lighting portrayal as much, because you're focusing on all the texture details and things like that in the image.
Interesting. Exactly. Okay, well, good stuff. Thanks for that, John. Our journey into the worlds of Unreal Engine 5 continues in our next news topic. Okay, so recently we've been talking a lot about anniversary stuff that we covered in the past. We talked about Uncharted 4, Doom 2016, 10-year anniversaries last week. Will, our colleague Will Judd, has put together a website that basically enables us to see what Digital Foundry videos were posted like 1 year ago, 5 years ago, and 10 years ago. And John, I'm looking at the 1 year ago and 5 years ago, and both of them actually have extensive content about new features for Unreal Engine 5. So last year, pretty much this week, we were looking at the Witcher 4 tech demo on Unreal Engine 5. But 5 years ago, which I guess is going to be the point of this discussion, we actually had our first hands-on experience with Unreal Engine 5 in the form of the Valley of the Ancient demo, which you talked about with Alex. Come a long way, right?
Yeah, this was an interesting time because this was, I guess, a year and some change after that initial reveal, as you noted, and this was like a more complete like look at what they were attempting with it. I think, wouldn't we receive a small tech demo from the Coalition at some point within this?
It was very brief, yeah.
Very, very brief, but yes, this was obviously an important point to discuss because we hadn't really seen much from Unreal yet for this current generation. I don't think anything had shipped with these features as of 2021.
No.
Maybe if they had, it was very, very limited.
The first thing I think was the Matrix Awakens demo, but that was late in 2021.
Yeah, exactly. So this was still very early on, and it was very promising. And I think now with some distance, we've kind of come to understand more of the limitations of this engine and some of its faults, but I still like the promise of what they showed here. As we discussed back in that video, I still remember though when we first got wind of this actually happening back in 2020. Do you remember when we got that tease? We were having a meeting with somebody else, and I won't say who, but their laptop right. had images.
Yeah, should we go into that? Because it is an interesting story. We had a pre-brief about something, let's just say. And yes. There were lots, and it was just when COVID was kicking off. And yep. There were lots of slides within this particular presentation. And several of them were skipped quite quickly. But because we were screen recording, because we kind of had to, we could pause and see, you know, hold on a minute. This looks like incredible, but you're not talking about it. What's going on? And then a bit later exactly. on, we saw some Unreal Engine 5 stuff, and here it is. And then the following year, which is the video that we're talking about here, is where we actually had the first reveal, I guess, of the Valley of the Ancient demo. And I'm just looking back at the content now, and to be fair, it looks absolutely incredible. It really does, in terms of like the detail level, the lighting. They seem to have done some good stuff. They did this demo on Xbox Series X before they actually released it on PC. And there's some nice, really, really nice post-processing effects even. And there's various highlights of other features that they were adding to the engine at this point. But it was, Oliver, it was still at the time where Unreal Engine 5 was being showcased via lots of rocks. Because foliage wasn't particularly friendly.
Yeah, that was like a very infamous era of UE5, in particular like 5.1 and 5.0. Every game that shipped on those engine versions had a kind of similar set of strengths and weaknesses, I would say, with regards to rendering its visuals. And indeed, when you look at something like this, and you look over to a title like RoboCop or even Hellblade, I think you're seeing a pretty much a straight line in terms of the kinds of visual phenomena that are being represented credibly by this. And all of the strengths and weaknesses of the engine, I think you're seeing a lot of those elements here. But yeah, I mean, just in general, these early Unreal Engine 5 demos just looked fantastic. And I think we did see that realized in the final shipping games. But I also think we, you know, did not necessarily see a lot of other elements that would come up later on as being potential performance problems and being potential issues with Unreal Engine 5, like the fact that, you know, a lot of Unreal Engine 5 games are largely static and even disable things like foliage animation, which can be very taxing in this engine. It has very significant performance penalties relative to player expectations this generation, and like image quality is often not the greatest in Unreal Engine 5 titles, especially when targeting 60 FPS. And obviously, the issues that John mentioned with lumen noise and the kind of stochastic, ugly speckling patterns that you see in titles that rely heavily on lumen to handle interactive fuse lighting. Those are all big problems, and those are problems that we came to see later. But I still think the engine's unique visual strengths are extraordinary, and like nothing else is going to depict a nice rocky crag like Unreal Engine 5, really. It's quite extraordinary looking in this state. But, you know, UE5 is very much in active development and continues to be iterated on massively. And I think that titles that ship in like 2 or 3 years that might be running on 5.8 or whatever will be very impressive indeed. And obviously, as you go into the next generation of consoles, you probably actually have the hardware power to realize Unreal Engine 5 titles to the level of fidelity the players will be happy with. But it's been kind of a little bit of an uncomfortable fit for this generation of consoles, ultimately. It's not been the best compromise always between image quality plus visual stability, performance, and a number of other priorities, as I think John has made abundantly clear and we've tried to make clear in content. It's not always the best set of choices when it comes to current generation software.
But let me push on this a little bit, Oliver, because I've been thinking about this, and I do think Unreal has its issues, and there's aspects of it I don't like, for sure. But when you reflect back on Unreal, you made the statement that, oh, you feel like it's slightly out of step with the console hardware of this generation. But one could argue that has always been true with Unreal, right? Mm-hmm. Unreal Engine 3, specifically, when that was revealed, they had some pretty big plans for it that were not really able to come to fruition on that generation of consoles. And in fact, nearly every Unreal Engine 3 game targeted 30 FPS at best, and especially on PlayStation 3, the triple, you were lucky if you got there. I mean, most games were not 30 FPS on that machine, and even on 360, like, getting a stable 30 was a difficult thing. Mm-hmm. You gave up a lot to run an Unreal, and a lot of the visual effects, a lot of the choices developers had to make produce some pretty nasty results that don't hold up that well. Even the prior Unreal Engine, it wasn't very scalable for like PlayStation 2 and GameCube, I would say, even though it appeared occasionally. And even on Xbox, performance was largely poor, right? Like, you play the Splinter Cell games, which were like a poster child for it at the time, their frame rate's not stable. It's often sub 30. It was not great in that regard. And then we get to Unreal Engine 4. Things got a little better, but we still were largely plagued by somewhat low frame rates across consoles. Like, actually smooth 60 FPS was mostly off the table. So in comparison, while Unreal Engine 5 I think has sacrificed a bit too much in terms of image quality, and there is temporal stability issues, when you actually look across the entire catalog of games that use these features, or even not using these features, I think we finally have a point where we have the largest selection of high-performance 60 FPS console games using Unreal Engine to date, where most games on this engine are 60. It's not always perfect, but it's way, way closer than ever before. And I think that kind of holds true for this whole generation. Like, image quality is the thing that has been sacrificed, but performance in general is really good this generation, if you're talking consoles. 60 FPS really has become the standard, and I think that's something we should step back and appreciate, because it is worth pointing out. It's something that we couldn't really dream of last generation or the generation before, especially with Unreal, where the CPU requirements made that basically impossible, especially on the Jaguar cores, right? That's just like, this time around, we really do have a lot of great running games, and I think that's awesome. Well, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I'm just reminded of The Matrix Awakens, which came out after this demo, obviously. And again, it was targeting 30 frames per second. So it did seem to be the case that all of those original demos were targeting 30 frames per second at acceptable resolutions, when TSR was doing a pretty good job there. But the gamers spoke, right? They said they wanted 60 frames per second, and so something had to give, and it was image quality, and it was stability at 60 frames per second. Interesting stuff. Oliver?
Yeah, I think this is really a game of expectations, like Rich mentioned. I think gamers just have very high expectations this generation for what performance should look like, for what image quality should look like. And that's been something that's come as a surprise to me. I certainly did not foresee the fact that 60 FPS would become the console standard refresh rate, frame rate this generation. It seemed like we were going to continue with, you know, maybe a little bit of 60 FPS at the beginning, as, you know, sometimes occurs, but it was going to fall back down to 30 FPS fairly rapidly, and that just did not occur. But yeah, I would totally agree with John that in general, Unreal Engine 5 titles are more performant, more stable, And running a lot better than Unreal Engine has in any prior generation of console hardware, really. But it just ultimately, it's a question of like, what do players want? And I think players have, a lot of players at least, have evinced the opinion that Unreal Engine 5 is not doing a good enough job. And in some cases, perhaps that's warranted. In some places, perhaps it's not. But, you know, I think Unreal Engine 5 software also has been improving quite a lot in terms of delivering 60 FPS modes. We've even seen some titles like Hellblade 2 upgraded to support 60 FPS and more recent Unreal Engine 5 versions. And also, like, even more recent Unreal Engine 5 open world titles, which is not historically something that Unreal Engine 5 has excelled at, have done pretty well. Like, I didn't think Mafia, the Old Country, was a perfect performer by any means, but it was still delivering, you know, an open world, albeit a somewhat static one without a lot of interactions or NPCs. But it, you know, mostly at 60 FPS with, you know, some dips here and there on the consoles. I thought that was a pretty good effort. Likewise with the title like Avowed, again, pretty good performance level. Outer Worlds 2, somewhat shakier performance level. But again, these are titles that are showing that you can absolutely deliver, you know, the utmost, basically, in game complexity, at least to a certain degree, on Unreal Engine 5, maybe with some compromises here and there. But still running at 60 FPS, which is something that should be commended, and certainly was not possible with earlier Unreal Engine versions that were not really compatible with such basic things as rendering foliage in an efficient manner, right?
Mm-hmm. I do think, Oliver, like, the games like that Oblivion remaster, for instance, tend to stick out
right, in those
memories for, like, having issues, and there are absolutely still games that ship with issues. But I would say today, when we say, oh, this game shipped with performance issues, we're talking like, you know, in the 40s maybe in terms of frame rate, whereas back, you know, a couple generations ago, not to say we shouldn't expect improvements, right, but, you know, on the PS triple, dude, like when you're talking bad performance, you're talking like 10 to 15 FPS drops, like nonstop tearing that could like slice an artery. Like, it was really, really bad back then, like so much worse than I think people remember. And we have, and then last gen was like mostly the land of like, here's this uncapped frame rate that runs at like 40 to 50 FPS. There were so many games that launched like that, and it kind of sucked because we didn't have VRR yet, even as an option. So I really feel like things are in a way better position now than I think people maybe give credit towards. So right.
I think going back to the Unreal Engine 5 content we did 1 year ago, the Witcher 4 tech demo, it's quite interesting to see that, well, we've got trees now. We can do trees in nanite. Also, 60 frames per second demo on a base PlayStation 5. There's been a kind of adjustment, a realization that this engine has to run at 60 and it has to run at 60 well. So, yeah, there's definitely progression there. But it is funny going back to that earlier presentation just to see. You saw some pretty amazing visuals, but you could see all of the limitations there, right? And developers have had to work around that for like 5 years now, which is quite remarkable. We've got 5.8 coming soon, which seems to have there's talk of isn't it like a more performant, cut down version of Lumen, right, Oliver?
Yeah, they're calling it the I believe in the documentation it's referred to as something like the Irradiance Cache Lumen, which seems to be, right, okay. I believe it's a primarily probe-based version of Lumen intended for higher performance on lower power devices, like I think they cryptically call it handheld gaming consoles, aka the Switch 2, because it does not describe any other device in the market at the moment that would be running on your launch to 5.8, to my knowledge at least.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good stuff. Well, let's move on to our final topic. Final topic for this particular episode of DF Direct Weekly. We're going to go back. We're going to go back 5 and indeed 10 years. 10 years ago this week, John, you produced the very first episode of Digital Foundry Retro, DF Retro, Quake Sega Saturn Analysis, The Impossible Port. And 5 years ago, to kind of like, I guess, celebrate 5 years of DF Retro, you did a massive blowout on Quake again, not just again. The Saturn version. Let's talk about DF Retro. How it came about.
Going back to those two episodes is fun to see, because I hope it shows the evolution that we got there, and it also kind of highlights why it started to take so much more time to make episodes and why the release cadence is kind of like up and down, if you will, because it's a serious time investment to make. But it didn't start that way, and at at the time, like, there wasn't really like any thought that we could do this kind of stuff on the channel, because you told me like every time I've tried it, just nobody cares.
Yeah,
right. But I really like this stuff, and it actually started from that Shenmue video. Remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Where we suspected that there was going to be Shenmue 3 announced in 2015, and I actually, or wait, it had been announced, but we expected we were going to see it in 2016. So I actually started working on a retrospective in preparation for that announcement. But somehow I got sidetracked, and that ended up just sitting on my hard drive for a while, and I never finished it until a bit later. But then at some point, I finally got my hands on a copy of Quake for the Saturn, which had always fascinated me, and I picked it up, and I just started playing it that afternoon. I was like, oh man, this is so freaking cool. So I just captured it and slammed together this video like in a few hours on the Saturday, and then uploaded it. And I was like, can we just run this? And you're like, yeah, sure. And we just decided, I just slapped retro on the normal DF logo and away we went. And then you made that, you picked a thumbnail, I guess, from Google Image Search, which is one of the, it's like a modded version of one of these demons, but with like little like eyebrows drawn on in black that you can just barely see, which I always thought was silly. But there it is. And that first episode came along and people liked it. Mm-hmm. So even though looking back, it's like so simple. And I actually had prototyped this before with that, like, I did that video on Hexen for the Saturn on my own channel, which was also of a similar vein. And then I just kind of ran from there instead of doing them. And I think after that, I went back to the Shenmue project to work on it. Right.
Yeah.
So I kind of kept plugging along and made a bunch of episodes, and they got increasingly larger, but not too huge. And then I guess in 2021, when we reopened the, or like updated the Patreon, right, we switched to doing DF Direct weekly for the first time, I guess, during this period. And I decided to sort of relaunch it a little bit. And Audie was able to work more closely with me at the time, although he did not work on this one. But I decided to do like the full Quake experience, because by this time I was also like getting super into like retro PCs. So I had tons of graphics cards. And when I got the Rendition Verite, I was like, oh man, now I can finally play and cover V Quake. And that kind of pushed me to want to do this. So for this, for that video, like, I mean, I made some custom levels. I did the credit sequence using the Quake engine just for fun. I really tried to do a lot of cool stuff with that and really showcase the game running on hardware of the era that I think not that much great direct capture even existed of at the time. And it was a good way to sort of embellish that and really showcase it. And then from there, you know, I just made a whole bunch of other episodes that summer. And interestingly, that's when I leveraged a lot of Unreal Engine at the time, because I was like playing around with Unreal, and I was making like sets for the videos and doing some of the emotion graphics rather than using like After Effects, which the interface is always annoying. I was like, what if I just do these in Unreal? Because Unreal has its own like video editing timeline, so you can just like build sets and put stuff in there and like animate things and like keyframe it all out, right? And then you just like render it out as a movie, and then bam, it just slots right into a video in Premiere. And it was kind of a fun, interesting way to do it. And I still sometimes fiddle with that. I kind of want to get back into that, because it was fun making, decorating virtual sets, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Like for the Motorstorm video, I did pull out all the Rocky meshes that Epic had in their early videos we were just talking about. So I put together like, you know, rocky areas that seemed fitting for Motorstorm. So that was fun. But yeah, and then I'm just happy that last year we finally got to launch the podcast version. So that's, I'm still have more real episodes that I want to do, and I have some plans for those, but they obviously do take a long time to make. So it's tough to dive in. But the podcast is something that, for me, it's a fun way to be able to talk about this stuff more regularly without having to commit that huge time investment every time. Mm-hmm. And it's just become like a regular thing, like the DF Direct Weekly, right? Where it's just getting together with some dudes and talking about our subjects that we enjoy that maybe don't always warrant a full video, or even if they do, like it would have been just like, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks of work to do it. This is a way to get it out in a way that's more fun and quick for me. So
I've just been enjoying Saturn Quake running at 12 frames per second. So it seems to vary between 12 to like 20-ish. It's quite funny.
I mean, you know, that's what are you going to do, right? It's the Saturn. It's the Saturn. It was not supposed to run Quake.
Yeah,
but they did it anyway. Those crazy guys. I think you're in the credits for that game, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, basically that was at the point where I was doing the official Sega Saturn magazine, and you know, those guys, Lobotomy Software, were just doing like beautiful things with the Saturn. You know, obviously they did Exhumed / Power Slave, Duke Nukem 3D, another great port. Not really a port as such. They basically just rebuilt the entire game within their own engine, and they did it again with Quake, and I couldn't quite believe that they'd done this on the Saturn, because you know, Quake at the time was the game that was melting, you know, certainly brought the era of the 486 gaming PC to an end. You had to go onto Pentium, and yet here's, you know, the Saturn actually doing a pretty good attempt at producing a Quake game and actually adding lighting effects that the original never had, which was pretty awesome. Famously, of course, John Carmack said it just wasn't possible. And then Lobotomy Software just sort of rolled up. I actually remember emailing John Carmack about it, and I got like a one sentence reply, just saying, "Yeah, it's really cool," something along those lines. I'd have to look that up. But yeah, it was really, really cool stuff. And in terms of like DF Retro, yeah, I mean, I remember back in the day, it was like, well, you know, we've tried retro stuff and it doesn't work. And actually, the thing is that we tried retro stuff, but we didn't have the right formula. And the formula is somebody deeply knowledgeable, passionate about the subject matter, willing to put in the time and the effort to create great content. And that's kind of what we hadn't done in the past, because we, you know, and it's similar when, you know, I remember when we, when IGN were involved, and it was kind of like, you know, they were kind of interested about retro gaming, but you know, it was kind of like, well, you know, it's a bunch of old games. Why should we be interested? Because that was quite interesting, because on the one hand, we had the marketing people's IGN saying, hey, game anniversaries, you know, they're always there. People have got a lot of interest in them. And then when it actually came to pitching more retro content, it's like, nah, not particularly interested. That was a bit of a weird sort of...
It was a weird
situation there. Oliver, what's your thoughts on DF Retro?
Well, you know, I've been a fan for quite a while. I do enjoy John's retro content, but my own personal tastes probably run a little bit fresher than John's, because I'm a little younger, and certainly the consoles that I grew up with primarily were, like, you know, frankly, seventh gen consoles. For me, at least, the formative memories that are in my head were really like 360 PS3 stuff. I mean, I did play, you know, substantially during, like, you know, GameCube, Xbox, that era, but it was pretty early in my life, so did not really engage with games really meaningfully until, like, you know, the Nintendo DS launch, PSP launch, then 360 launch, all that good stuff. I think my favorite DF retros that John has done, my favorite DF retro for sure that John has done, is the one I did with Corey on Final Fantasy 13 and its sequels. That was just a really nicely produced video. Commemorating a game that I think in time is seen more fondly, but at the time was very, very controversial with its very limited structure, narrow structure, linear structure. I think it was a really, really amazing RPG that has earned a lot of plaudits in time, even if at the time people were disappointed to some degree in the way that Square Enix chose to progress that series. And also the PS3 1080p retrospective one was great, and obviously the recent Microsoft Xbox 360 retrospective on the launch titles.
I'm just looking at YouTube, funnily enough, and it's quite interesting how the recommended side column is actually offering some really interesting stuff, John. Stuff that's being recommended is you did a Quake 2 video.
Oh, yes. I remember that, yeah.
Currently sitting on 524,000 views. People liked it, obviously. 8 years ago, you did Power Slave / Exhumed. All good stuff. I'm also looking, and this one possibly quite controversial. We'll be talking about like 10-year anniversaries here. 7 years ago, you did a Killzone 2 10-year retrospective. So, yeah, you actually moved into the area of the triple. We've not really done so much on that in DF Retro. It kind of feels a bit weird, doesn't it? It's a bit of a tweener era at this point.
That 1080p dream video, man, that was good fun to make.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. I mean, you know, DF Retro, it's actually become a really important part of what we do. And I'm just, you know, it's one of these situations where we really want to give the staff the opportunity to do stuff that they really enjoy doing. The idea being that if they love doing it, that love will come through in the content and hopefully resonate with some part of the audience. Then, you know, you get a reaction, right? You understand that, hey, maybe there's something interesting here. Maybe there's something we can build upon here. And, you know, to still be doing it 10 years later, I think is just astonishingly cool, right? And also, you know, I was just thinking back to some of the earlier stuff that I did back in the day. And back in the day, magazines, which I worked on, had a very short shelf life, right? You know, a few years. You know, it's actually very, very rare for a magazine to actually persist into, you know, double digits. And I think Edge magazine's pretty much the only one left, really. Possibly Retro Gamer, I'm not sure. But here we are, 10 years of DF Retro, continuing to do it, continuing to love it, continuing to get that audience. It's great stuff. Right, brilliant. Well, I think that's the last topic of the show, therefore the end of the show. Please do like, subscribe, share if you enjoyed it. Ring the bell for notifications, that kind of stuff. A DF supporter program, patreon.com/digitalfoundry. Join us, get early access to the direct, that kind of thing. It helps make stuff like DF Retro possible and the DF Retro Super Show, of course. I mean, we're not doing a retro podcast for the views, let's put it that way. You know,
No, I know.
We're doing it because, you know, it's what we want to do. We think it resonates with the audience, but it, you know, it's the kind of thing that does need support, so please do consider that. But that's all from us on this one, and I guess we'll see you soon for the next Q&A show. But in the meantime, thanks for watching and supporting Digital Foundry.